Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Gunter Wolf. I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm joining you today here from Washington, D.C. It's 6 o'clock in the morning before the first morning coffee. And I'm joined by Alicia Garcia Herrero, who sits actually in Hong Kong. And I think, Alicia, it's 6 o'clock in the evening over there.
That's right. Hello, well, Gunter. Good morning to you.
Welcome, and thank you for joining. So this week I want to talk with Alicia about the EU-China agreement. So this Tuesday, the President of the European Commission, the President of the European Council, and the Prime Minister of China met in Brussels, and they came out with a joint communique, which is more than 7 pages long, has lots of points in there, and has very high ambitions in many respects. For example, it talks about the need of the EU and China to commit to a bilateral economic relationship based on openness, non-discrimination, and fair competition, ensuring a level playing field, transparency, and mutual benefits. It talks about the fact that the relation in trade and investment should be equitable and mutually beneficial. And it talks about the willingness to enhance bilateral economic cooperation. Now, looking at this from the Washington perspective, it almost looks like has the EU and China found a deal, or is that more cheap words without actual actions? Alicia, what do you think?
Well, I think I have mixed answer to your question, Guntram, meaning I think on some areas there is a very clear consensus between the EU and China. We can think about one part of the WTO reform, which is the reform of the appellate body. It is very clear in the statement that this is something they agree and that they want to push, and they even mentioned the Osaka G20 meeting. I mean, these things were, they seem to work in tandem very clearly, of course, on environmental and, you know, targets, on I guess this, you know, probably part of the WTO reform, not all, I mean, appellate body only, and environment are probably the key drivers of this cooperative reading of this communique. There are, however, other areas of the communique where you can feel the tension. Starting with the very same WTO reform, there is a part at the beginning of the communique which focuses more on subsidies and, you know, on things that it doesn't really say that China doesn't agree to it, but it's like a EU position in the paper, yeah? For example, the EU supports China to seek faster progress towards joining the WTO government procurement agreement. You know, so the EU pushes China on. Well, interestingly, and I think that I'm sure there's been a lot of discussion on this. There's not a paragraph there saying China pushes the EU to agree on China remaining an emerging, a developing country for the WTO. So yes. Probably there's been some discussion as to that paragraph might have been included, and knowing that the developed world as a whole, not only Europe, is very, very, you know, wary of additional transition periods for China thanks to that status. I think this is probably something that was not included, or because the EU was adamant that this is not something that can be agreed upon.
Just on this point on the developing country status, China, of course, very clearly insists on the fact that it's still a developing country. Yeah. Can you just remind us why this matters? I mean, you have more rights when you come to the WTO and has less obligations.
First of all, the WTO doesn't have a concrete definition of emerging, emerging or developing country as the World Bank has. But of course, World Bank definition applies to some of the benefits of being a developing country, such as preferential tariffs and etc. that probably would no longer ever apply to China anymore. So we're not talking preferential tariffs anymore, because that really China has gone beyond the income per capita as defined by the World Bank. And in fact, Europe has long already lifted that preferential status for China. But there are other things that, so those gray areas, for example, again, procurement or subsidies, or so that those gray areas where China can navigate, think about especially SOEs and subsidies, I think is the most obvious one, which would give China leeway and time to adapt to a new WTO where all of these issues become more apparent. So this is the trick. It's not white or black. It's something that is subject to negotiation, where China can have a very relevant role, and where the rest of the emerging world may as well follow China. And think about India. So there may be a lot of consensus based on who is behind China to support this idea of perhaps even a definition of what a developing country is for the WTO, which doesn't really exist today. So these are the discussions. It's not something already on paper, but I think it's China wants to put that up front and then start negotiating the definition of what that really means for them. How long the transition period, and in which areas will they benefit from that status? Yeah.
So Alicia, let's zoom a little bit in on this issue of industrial subsidies, which the President Tusk has very much emphasized, and which is one of the big points that, of course, the European Union, but also the US, are complaining very bitterly about. It's the fact that China is not only using industrial subsidies for private companies, but it also uses SOEs to subsidize certain activities, and it's all quite intransparent. Yeah. And the notifications that China is giving to the WTO are also often judged as very insufficient and intransparent. And so the summit conclusion actually talks here, and let me quote: the two sides reaffirm their joint commitment to cooperate on WTO reform. And so on. And to this end, both sides will intensify the discussions with the aim of strengthening international rules on industrial subsidies, building on the work developed in the joint EU-China working group on WTO reform. So this is, of course, a key question. And and I guess in the end, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So it's great that they agreed to discuss that. But will it make a difference in the end? I think that's the big fundamental question.
Yes. So this is indeed a complicated but absolutely essential question, both for WTO reform, but also for the equal footing that the communique basically starts with. Yeah, at the very early stage in the communique, there's this very a grandiose statement of equal market access and, you know, all of those equal, it doesn't go all the way to reciprocity, but, you know, it basically sounds, please give us equal footing and equal competition in your market, or for that matter, in our market, because industrial subsidies do not only support Chinese corporates in their market, but it actually helps them go overseas, which is, of course, why this is becoming an increasingly important topic. Yeah, it's no longer only China's market, which by itself is, of course, very appealing given its size. It's about our own market. So in that regard, that essential question seems to be dealt with in two directions, in my opinion. China knows that it's cornered on this topic. It's not only the U.S., it's the EU, and they need to think of the best way to quell, if I may say, the criticism. One way is this task force for the reform of the WTO, which I'm sure they are discussing, but again, if they manage to get emerging market status, it may be like, yes, you have to be white or whatever. Yeah, I mean, pretty, maybe not white, but, you know, pretty and slim in 20 years, but it's 20 years. Yeah. So who cares?
Yeah.
The other thing, I guess this is one of the ways they are approaching that topic. Yes, lovely. This is the status quo when you know, we'll be done with our reforms, but give us time. The other strategy that China is pursuing is really this very interesting concept of competitive neutrality. And this is basically an OECD, well, it's actually originated in Australia, but an OECD concept for basically the OECD, again, members. China isn't a member. Let's start by realizing that it's an imported concept, so far so good, but it's a concept that basically China can adopt without, however, being imposed any conditionality of any sort, because it's not even a member of the OECD. So it's great to hear that, yes, they want to ensure competitive neutrality in their market between private and state-owned companies. But the point is, who's going to prove that thing is reached? And this is why I'm saying that I see it more as a way for China to quell this criticism. So through both ways, yeah? WTO reform, task force, as you mentioned, and competitive neutrality, neutrality, two parallel ways to convince the world, and by the world I mean probably mostly the US and Europe, that they're working in this direction.
Well, I mean, if I may, I mean, there's of course two possible views on this. One view is one that is one perhaps that one can call that an impatient view, which says basically, well, I mean, they might commit to do something in 20 years' time, but, you know, in the meantime, our economies, European economies, suffer, and so this is too slow. And the other view is the more patient view, which would say, well, China, as a matter of fact, does still have a GDP per capita which is below the level of Bulgaria, even. Because it's such a big country. I mean, in parts, of course, it's rich, but in significant parts, it's very poor. So this is a huge economy, which has very serious issues as it transforms and needs the time to transform. And so that would be the view that would say, well, basically, China is on the rise and it needs the time to adapt its system. And so I talked yesterday here to a former Obama, senior Obama official, and his view, of course, was, well, look, I mean, what he said is, the bipartisan view in the U.S. by now has become the one that is more impatient, that says, well, look, I mean, we've been talking the last 10 years about these things with China, and now China still hasn't moved, so the only way they're going to move is by putting up massive pressure. Now, I think in Europe there is still a little bit of a view of perhaps trying to be more collaborative and a little bit more understanding. And, you know, the fact that this agreement has been signed and it's so long and so comprehensive and includes issues, frankly speaking, that I found quite surprising. For example, this issue that China and the EU recall the validity of the UN resolution on Iran that was unanimously decided by the previous, also by the previous US administration. So there's lots of signals here showing that the EU perhaps might be more on the patient side and might be ready to strike a slightly different course than the US. Do you see that differently, or where do you see this falling?
Commission position paper that was published a couple of weeks ago was clearly quite a change for in terms of a more aggressive position. But yes, the communique looks more complacent. Maybe complacent is already a subjective word that indicates what I'm going to say next, but more accommodative. Yeah, and you may say, well, what else to do? You also have a very, very belligerent US, even with Europe, so meaning, you know, where to go. Yeah, I mean, if you can't fight both battles and kind of have everybody against you. So I understand that they used trying to be more conciliatory with one part of the two large hegemons, or at least for China, potential hegemons, if not already one. I understand where they're coming from, but we can't be naive either, meaning at the time of somebody putting a lot of pressure, i.e. the U.S., our negotiating power will only be lower if we don't do that. Imagine in what to me is a likely scenario, the EU and China come up with and of course these other groups which are quite also quite engaged in this, led by Canada on the reform of the WTO. But imagine that China, through these working groups, and gets to a reform that is that fulfills the EU's vision of the world on trade. However, they get a very long transition.
Yes.
And through that transition, they continue to work on their industrial policy. Of course, the US is still very negative about all of this, but they have the rest of the world supporting that vision. Well, frankly speaking, then we will end up with even more sectors. I'm talking about Europe, in which we have lost our comparative advantage. Yeah, think about robotics or sectors where, you know, we could still have some room where we won't have it anymore. So this is why I think that understanding why this is happening, I would still keep a very strong, you know, say, or a very tight position on things that we think are absolutely essential. And this is one. And it goes beyond subsidies, because think about indigenous innovation and the massive subsidization of innovation in China, which only applies to Chinese companies or registered as such. So any foreign company that actually is registered as a local company with what that really means, which is forced technological transfer among many other things, receive subsidies. But, you know, nobody wants to do that, because basically subsidies to build something that you won't have anymore by definition. So I think there are things where we cannot backtrack. This would be my argument. And on this one, I don't think we can, because China has been very, very smart in using the available time, that transition. Think about the market economy reality, yeah? So basically, the whole idea was that you don't need to prove you're a market economy. As time goes by, 2016, yeah, December, you become one. I mean, what is this? You see, I worry about this kind of, mechanic approaches to reform, meaning time goes by and nothing really actually happens, but I become what you want me to be. Well, not really. You need to demonstrate that that's where you're heading. And frankly, why I'm negative on this, because if they were really keen to reduce these subsidies, or to have this competitive neutrality that is arguably a goal, but only arguably, you would see things happening in China that are not what the things we're seeing. For example, now SOEs are getting massive amount of perpetual bonds issued following the banks in China. Now, you wonder, why are they getting capital out of perpetual bonds? Why aren't they doing, you know, like, I don't know, opening up to strategic foreign investors, or even IPOs for that matter, but full, yeah? I mean, pass on controls to the private sector, at least for non-strategic sectors. There's not a single sector in China that is going through that process. So I really think that the state wants to keep a stronghold on many sectors. And this is why I'm a little bit hesitant to believe that it's going to change without pressure, frankly speaking.
Well, I mean, the question is if it ever is going to change. I mean, pressure could also backfire, obviously, and in China could retrench. And I think there is also a big debate one has to consider very carefully in which sectors SOEs and state subsidization of the kind you describe is actually a serious problem, and in which sectors it's just a minor nuisance. It seems to me that we know for a fact that SOEs are probably less effective and less innovative than private companies. And so in a sense, if China was becoming much more private economy driven country, its growth rate might even be stronger than it is currently. I think that's one argument. And I think the second big argument, it seems to me, is that, frankly speaking, there are some sectors where I'm really worried, and that's sectors where you have network effects. So you mentioned artificial intelligence, big data firms, and so on. I mean, in these sectors, we know that if you get subsidized and you can create a huge size early on, I mean, you really lock in very big advantages. Yes. While in, let's say, in other sectors, such as steel, which is actually also mentioned in the communique, and on which they continue to work on reducing overcapacities. But in steel, essentially, China subsidizes consumers around the world. I mean, that goes, yes, it goes to the expense of some producers in the rest of the world, but it is a huge subsidy also for consumers. So the long-term worry in the steel sector, I think, is much less relevant than in the network sectors.
But subsidization happens, again, through indigenous innovation generally, not only for big overcapacity SOEs, and a more general subsidization comes from the fact that the banking sector is dominated by state-owned banks, with of course full protect. I mean, dominated still today with full protection from the government, and who are becoming increasingly large compared to banks in the rest of the world, and which can get funding at a much lower cost than banks globally, if anything, because they're, if you see what is happening now, just to give you a number, to see how this translates into, of course, companies with network externalities, but any company, even private, I mean, any, whether private or public, into an implicit subsidy. So think about Bank of China, the first bank that has issued a perpetual in February, early February. The part of that perpetual, a small part to be precise, has been bought by the PBOC through a swap line, so something not very different from the ECB, by the way. So not that we can give any lessons, but the point is that the actual spread from the sovereign is only 120 basis points for the same rating than many European banks, which pay 400 plus on the sovereign. What I'm trying to say is that because of this model, this bank, BOC or any other, can actually lend cheaper. You see, because the access to capital is in a way is subsidized, and thus their own lending is subsidized indirectly. It's very hard to measure that subsidy. That is why sometimes I laugh when I hear U.S. negotiators coming up with statements like, give us the subsidy list, as if such thing could be summarized on a piece of paper.
So the biggest subsidy is indeed, or one of the biggest subsidies is indeed very cheap lending. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today's podcast. We could go on for hours, but for sure, this issue of EU-China relations, the way the Chinese economy will transform, and the way this will play also in relation to the United States, is one of the key issues to look at. I'm very glad that you, Alicia, joined us today in the podcast to discuss some of the issues for this episode of the Director's Cut. Thank you for joining today, and talk to you next time.
Thank you, Guntram. Thank you so much for the call. Thank you.